GEBU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, a community forum about the use of drones. This community forum on the use of drones will take place Thursday, August 7th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. Speakers include retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, Brian Whiteside, Peter Lumsdaine, and Oregon State Representative Jennifer Williamson. Again, that's Drones in Oregon, a community forum on Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And they'll be mine, all mine, practicing 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T as part of the Cinema Under the Stars program on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a musical fantasy film with the story, screenplay, and lyrics written by Dr. Seuss. Before the film, the Grand Style Orchestra will be playing a set of improvisational free jazz music. Again, that's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, part of the Top Down Cinema series of the Northwest Film Center, on August 7th on the roof of the Hotel Deluxe's parking structure at Southwest 15th and Yamhill. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is about 9:01 a.m., Coming up this morning on KBOO, next is APA Compass, a monthly show produced by KBOO's Asian and Pacific Islander Collective. Today's show features musician Simon Tam on why he's not allowed to trademark his band's name, The Slants, and how he's responding. And Pulitzer Prize winner Alex Tizan explores and punctures stereotypes of the Asian American male identity in his book Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, followed by Flashpoints at 10:15. At 11, it's It Takes a Village, followed by Between the Lines. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. And now, APA Compass.
Good morning. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program, with your hosts Sarika Mehta and Andrew Ye. On today's program, we feature Portland musician and TED Talk speaker Simon Tam, who tells us why the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office will not allow him to trademark his band's name, The Slants, and how he's responding. Also, youth contributor Sarah Anitska expounds upon her college application quandary in her latest Angry APA Minute. But first, Pulitzer Prize winner Alex Tizan explores and punctures stereotypes of the Asian American male identity in his book, Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and today we're speaking with Alex Tizan, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and author of Big Little Man, an excellent book exploring the Asian American male experience in the United States. Alex, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
You have a chapter in your book called Getting Tall, and it has some very unexpected facts about the science of height, including that the average height of a population can change dramatically over brief periods of time.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So 150 years ago, Dutch men, the Dutch population was the shortest population in all of Europe. And in a short span of time, in 150 years or four or five generations, the Dutch have gone from being the shortest in Europe to being the tallest in the world on average. And the scientists and researchers who've been looking at this and who've been fascinated by this, you know, have determined that, yes, height is something that can change radically over a historically short period of time. And we're seeing that happen right now in Asia. We're seeing it in Japan, where in as little as one or two generations, the average height of Japanese men will be equivalent to the average height of American men. That's what the forecast is. We're seeing that in South Korea. We're seeing it in Taiwan. We're seeing it in the wealthier, modernized regions of China. And we're seeing it even in the less developed countries where Western diet and Western healthcare has had a big influence in the general welfare of the population. You're seeing it in places like, you know, the Philippines and Thailand and Indonesia. I travel to the Philippines regularly, and when I travel in the bigger cities in Manila, you know, it's not unusual to see these big honking teenagers, these 15, 16, 17-year-olds who are, 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". I mean, they would have been freaks 50 years ago, but today, getting to be common.
Could you take us back to your college years? You have a scene in your book, you had conversations with your friends, male, female, Asian, white, black, which convinced you that you belonged to an undesirable category?
College was probably it really hit home for me that Asian men were, as a whole, were considered an undesirable group. I just overheard too many conversations among white and black classmates, you know, who would make jokes, and sometimes they wouldn't make jokes. They would just say things in all seriousness. For example, I had a good friend, a white guy who lived in the same dorm as me my freshman year, who, you know, walking through campus one day with him, you know, he was looking at this group of Asian men in the distance, and he just turned to me and just said he thought that Asian men were the ugliest people on earth. without taking into account that I was an Asian man, because he didn't see me as an Asian man. He saw me, he said, as Alex. I heard a lot of comments like that. And I still hear occasional comments like that, not quite that crude or that cruel. And I think that my friend actually changed his views as he got older. I mean, he was a 17-year-old dumb at the time he said that. But, you know, I was a 17-year-old dumb myself. And I sort of absorbed these comments and took them personally.
And you also mentioned that...
I heard enough comments, and the comments corroborated what I saw in the movies and on television and what I learned in school. All of these corroborated each other. And the idea was that, yes, Asian men didn't rank very high when it came to desirability or in masculinity.
You also talk about that some of your social isolation was self-imposed, you know, due to your buying into the negative stereotypes. You know, you talk about this concept of self-selection, right?
Yes, and that's big. That's really big, and it's really difficult to know exactly how much of my experience was because of, you know, realities that existed outside of myself, and how much of it was self-created. It's impossible to know. Was it half and half? Was it one-third, two-thirds? All I can say now is that I look back, and I do see that much of my experience, much of it, was in fact self-imposed. That I had absorbed these ideas that we've been talking about. I absorbed them, and I guess the sociological term is that I internalized them. And I believed them. And because I believed them, because I believed that I was less of a man than my white and black brothers, I often took myself out of the game, because I didn't feel worthy to be in the game. And that's what I referred to as self-selection. I selected myself in the Darwinian sense. I selected myself out of these competitions and these arenas where I felt like I didn't have a chance. Yeah, that was that definitely contributed to my isolation.
So if you could relive those college years now, knowing what you know now, what would you do differently?
Oh, I'd have so much more fun. I really would. Are you kidding? No, I'd have so much more fun. I mean, I do look back on those college years, for example, and when I force myself to, I do remember, for example, women being interested in me. Not a whole lot of women, but some. I think that if I didn't have those shackles in my own brain, the shackles that I carried around with me that held me back, that, oh man, I could have had a much, much different experience. And I eventually did have those experiences when I was older, as I got older. I think that if I could do it again, a lot of that self-imposed exile would not affect me as much, or it wouldn't come into play as much. That's not to say that the exterior realities wouldn't still be there, because they would. But I wouldn't hold myself back.
So you also spend a fair amount of time on the college campuses nowadays. And you've noticed a change, among the students now versus, what you experienced.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the term post-racial might be overstating it, but I do see a lot more intermixing, a lot more easy intermixing between all the different ethnic and racial groups on campuses. I'm seeing, Asian men with all sorts of women. And I'm seeing, one encouraging thing is I'm seeing a lot more Asian American men with Asian American women, which when I was in my teens and early 20s, it was harder to find because a lot of the Asian women that I knew preferred white men, and that's who they would date. But I'm seeing lots of Asian American women decide to choose Asian men as their partners, Asian American men, and I think that's a really encouraging sign overall. And I'm seeing these changes happen, with my own children and my own nieces and nephews too. The way they talk about other groups of people, there's so much more inclusion, and there is that sense that they really don't see the differences in race and ethnicity. It isn't an issue with many of them.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking with Alex Tizon, author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self.
You have 5 married sisters, of which 4 have white men husbands. And all of your sisters profess that race has nothing to do with their mutual attraction, that their love was blind to race and color. Can you make sense of this apparent contradiction between, the statistics indicating that race is significant when Asian American women are choosing spouses, yet you have so many individuals saying otherwise?
Yeah, nobody is going to admit, or very few people are going to admit, that race plays a role in their choice of partner. Why? Because it's not correct politically to do so. But to me, there's no question that race comes into play when choosing a partner. And I think for my sisters, they may not have been aware, like most people are not aware of the presumptions that they carry around and the particular worldview that they've absorbed through living in this culture. They may not be completely aware of it, but the statistics don't lie. And the fact that 4 out of my 5 sisters married white men, and actually a 5th sister is seriously dating a man now who happens to be white. And all these white men happen to be, wonderful human beings, and I love them all. But if I bring up to them the fact that they're marrying these white men, I think all of them would probably say, well, race wasn't really a factor. It was just that we found them attractive, and we found them, you know, they had the qualities that we wanted. And that's how they would understand it, and that's how they would express it. But if they followed that line of thinking far enough, I think that it feeds into this idea that these qualities that they were looking for were part and parcel of being white, and that desire for these particular qualities resided in white males. So, in my opinion, the reason why many people, including my sisters, wouldn't say that race played a factor is because they haven't needed to think of these ideas all the way through to the end. Now, I'm not saying they married these men just because they were white. I mean, there were other factors at play, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that their vision of beauty, for example, their vision of what made men attractive, I think that many of those qualities are qualities that have quote unquote white characteristics. Right? So if they had to pick, for example, a handsome man, I think that if they pictured that man in their head, that man would probably be white.
The insidious cultural influence, right? You pick
up...
Oh,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are... it's all around us. It's not just, you know, it's mass media. I mean, there's entertainment media, there's news media, there's the history that we learned in schools, there's the fact that American pop culture is probably it's probably the most powerful cultural influence on Earth. So that the heroes and heroines of American pop culture become the heroes and heroines globally. So people living in a small village in Cambodia, or the Philippines, or Thailand, or China, who happen to have access to cable, will absorb all these Western ideas and all these Western ideals. These ideals, they happen to be embodied by white people. And that's not necessarily an evil thing. It's not some sort of conspiracy. I mean, America and America is still largely populated by Caucasians, and people tend to when it's time to depict a hero, they'll tend to depict heroes that are similar to them. So, you know, in some ways, they're doing what comes naturally.
So you write that you know, TV and Hollywood, they're guilty of symbolic annihilation of Asian American men. And so, can you explain this concept?
Oh yeah, that's absolutely true. And I love that word, annihilate. it's so powerful. It's so strong. But that's pretty much what I see, especially growing up in the United States in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Symbolic annihilation, it refers to rendering certain people invisible. And that's essentially what happens to Asian men, particularly in entertainment media, up until the last decade or so. Asian men... either were not seen, were not on the screen at all, or when they were seen, they played these roles that were demeaning. They played houseboys, servants, occasionally villains. They played weaklings. They were the people that were killed first. They were, overall, they were unappealing characters, not the kind of characters that, you know, that instill any kind of inspiration or pride. Sometimes I would see these Asian characters on television and I would think, wow, it'd be better if they weren't there at all. And, And those are the two options for Asian men. They're either not there, or when they're there, they are wimps or losers. With great changes happening, the perceptions of Asian and Asian American men are definitely changing, and they're changing for a whole host of reasons. One is that the Asian American men who are growing up now, who are coming into their own now, are homegrown. They're not like I was. I was born in Asia and moved here when I was a child, and I still had these language issues to deal with growing up. The homegrown Asian American men today, they don't deal with the language problem. They're fully fluent in culture. They've been eating American food, and so they're bigger. They have all these advantages that immigrants didn't have. So you've got these generations of Asians that are coming up who are just as mobile and fluent and capable in Western culture. And then, the other thing that's happening is that Asia as a continent is rising very rapidly geopolitically. They're rising in political power. They're definitely rising economically in 20 or 30 years. Four out of the five largest economies in the world are going to be in Asia. And economics, whether we want to admit it or not, economics dictate much of what happens in popular culture. So as economies in Asia rise, there'll be a proliferation of, for example, movie studios and these creative people who will be making movies of their own, who you would think would have Asian leading men and Asian leading women, strong Asian characters. And I believe that many of these movies will find their way to the West, particularly as the East flexes its political and economic power. And when you start seeing these powerful Asian images on the screen, the little screen and the big screen, that'll go a long ways in changing perceptions. And that's happening right now. That you we're seeing the beginnings of that right now. So as these images in television and movies and these characters in all sorts of narratives, as they change, I think perceptions will also change.
We've been chatting with Alex Tizon, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Alex, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Andrew. Spread the word. Tell people about this. I'm wanting Asian American men and women to at least know the forces at work. It may not change things rapidly, but at least they'll understand what's going on. And that would be a major accomplishment.
I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. In the studio today, I'm chatting with Portland's very own Simon Tam. Simon is the founder and bassist for the dance rock band The Slants. That was also the music you were just listening to in the background. Simon Tam is also a speaker and activist, having given TED Talks on race and language. He recently published a book, Music Business Hacks, The Daily Habits of the Self-Made Musician, which is on sale now. Currently, his band has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office with regards to the name of his band. In studio, we also have fellow APA Compass member Andrew Yeh. But first, Simon, welcome back to APA Compass.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's first start out with telling us a little bit about your band before we get to the lawsuit. But you are the only, as far as we know,
all Asian American dance band, and you call yourselves Chinatown Dance Rock. So tell us about that first.
Well, it was kind of inspired by an Asian American hip hop group called the Notorious MSG, because they called themselves the original Chinatown Bad Boys. And I remember when I saw that, I thought that is such a cool sounding thing that it kind of made me rethink how we would describe our own music. And what's interesting about Chinatowns is that they often involve other Asian ethnicities that aren't just the Chinese community. It's often just kind of that that entry point for a lot of Southeast Asian immigrants, and we tend to be kind of pan-Asian in that respect. And so it kind of reflected our band as well. I mean, I am Chinese and Taiwanese, but the ethnicities of my fellow band members come from all different parts of Southeast Asia. So it's just kind of a fun way to represent ourselves while sounding like kind of tough and cool.
Right, because there aren't a whole lot of groups like you. I mean, we were talking about Far East Movement is the only Asian American rap group out there, but otherwise,
as far as like mainstream, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some other bands coming up that do like indie rock, or there certainly are. There's a whole collection of like YouTube stars, the Asian Americans doing like acoustic covers and that sort of thing. But there's not a lot like synth pop, heavy rock kind of stuff like what we do. And maybe it's just our particular generation. We grew up in just that right time where we fell in love with Depeche Mode and The Cure and New Order and all these other great bands. And you know, but we loved the music, but we didn't see ourselves in it. And so for us, we wanted to just kind of craft that identity that others could relate to, especially people around our age and our generation who love that kind of new wave sound. But now we can have maybe a more culturally relevant one.
Exactly. In fact, I was curious how your audience has received your music. Your band was founded in 2006, correct?
Yes.
And I mean, that was, you know, some time ago. So I'm curious how the audiences have changed, or what have you noticed about how the audience has received your music since then?
Well, we kind of like have an interesting audience. Like when we play in venues like clubs and bars and that sort of thing, there's a generation of people closer to our age who say, yeah, I remember growing up in the 80s. I love this kind of sound. And then we have a very young audience cultivated from us playing at anime conventions around the country who think it's a new sound. So it's kind of interesting because they didn't grow up with those bands. And so they're like, wow, you got a lot of synthesizers and keyboards and your rock music. So it's kind of funny to see how that plays out. But we're able to introduce those kind of younger audiences to some of our you know, our inspiration. So it's nice to kind of relive that and kind of get it out there. But I think over the last few years, especially those demographics have kind of been merging, because a lot of those anime audiences are getting older, and so they've kind of come to know us and liked our sound and how that's kind of evolved as well over the last few.
I was curious, I mean, your band is loved worldwide, so we can talk about, and we will, you know, the Asian American politics of this, but how have non-American audiences received your music?
Generally, it's been very widely received. People, I mean, I think first and foremost, we are a band and we play music, and we try and make it accessible to even those who don't necessarily share our experiences as far as like race. We want to make music that makes people move, and so I think people could definitely appreciate that. You know, the other part is, and this happened much more early on when we were just starting, people would kind of point out our ethnicities. Like when we show up at clubs, there were several times where people laugh at us. Like, what are all these Asians doing here? Oh, they have keyboards? That's so cliche. But when we started playing, and you know, we have a very bombastic, live, energetic show. Our old lead singer used to breathe fire and do all these crazy things. And you would see their jaws drop, and all of a sudden they stop laughing, and they're like, wow, these guys are really serious. You know, we've had people come up and apologize for believing in these stereotypes about Asians playing keyboards and thinking that we're all like really quiet and reserved, and we're blown away. And so it's really, to me, that was a lot of fun. It's just demolishing those stereotypes and allowing the music to speak for itself and to kind of give us a different kind of credibility with those audiences.
Is it hard actually to find gigs and set up venues? Because if there's a difference between the stereotype of people, what people think of your group versus what you actually are?
Early on, yeah, it was a little more difficult because people would make assumptions about what we did, even though I would straight out explain what the kind of music we played, and we had websites, MySpace back then, where you could listen to the music. Some venues were reluctant. They're like, well, I don't know if people would show up for a bunch of Asians. Even as recent as 2012, we were playing in Europe, and someone called us Oriental music, and I was like, what does that even sound like? You know, because they just saw that our picture on a poster, and they were like, well, I didn't really know what Oriental music would sound like, but you guys really rocked, and so I really liked it. And it was kind of one of those weird situations where, like, did you just slap me in the face and compliment me? But
yes.
Yeah, so I mean, and it just, again, proving the existence of like microaggressions and that kind of thing. But you know, it's been really fun to be able to use that as a way to kind of engage in these more meaningful discussions about our own identities.
I want to get to talking about the lawsuit in a moment, but I was curious, after you guys filed the lawsuit, have you noticed a change in audiences and fan base and things like that?
Well, a lot more Asian Americans voiced their support of our work, and that was really, really encouraging, really cool to see that they're saying, coming out in droves saying that, you know, our music doesn't disparage Asian Americans, we actually celebrate it. We got a lot of wonderful, encouraging letters from Asian Americans of all generations saying how they really liked that we were this bold portrayal of Asian American culture. And so that's been really neat. And at the same time, because we've been featured in a lot of non-traditional sources, like we were recently in a bunch of sports pages, like the sports section of USA Today, and we were on BBC and all these other places, we've been able to reach out to audiences that probably never would have even considered us before. So so it's been kind of neat that people talk about it because they see this political interaction that's happening. There's definitely a shift in our culture where people still see race and culture as important messages, the things that people can identify with. And so we've been tapping into like a more news savvy audience. So that's been neat.
Right. Well, let's get to it. Your band has filed a lawsuit against the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Tell us the story of how all of that started.
Well, it started about 5 years ago. My attorney at the time recommended that we file a trademark for our band's name, which is actually pretty common, especially for artists who are kind of up and coming, who are kind of hitting the national scene. It's just to protect your brand, just like in any business or anything like that. And so we went and had filed. But a couple months later, he calls me on the phone and he says, hey, there was an issue with your trademark application. And so I ask him, so, you know, what's the problem? And he's like, well, they denied it. They said, your name is disparaging to persons of Asian descent. And I remember sitting there thinking, and I was like, wait, do they know we're of Asian descent? And he's like, yeah, I think so. And I was like, do they know we play like Asian festivals or in the Asian media? And he's like, yeah, I think so. And I'm like, well, you know, I didn't even know there was a law against this. So what kind of evidence did they actually bring to show that we're offending Asian people? And he said, well, they used UrbanDictionary.com. And then there's this photo of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant-eyed gesture. And that's about it. And I was like, so they didn't find any Asians that were actually offended by what we did. They just found like white people who are offended, and they went to like
and
a
Urban
wiki
Dictionary.
Source. Yeah. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I think we should fight this thing. And, you know, that turned out to be a very, very long process that we're still involved with now. But it's kind of evolved over time because originally we just kept fighting, saying, hey, we're not offensive. Here's a bunch of Asians to prove it. Here's a survey. Here's a dictionary expert. Here's all this stuff. They didn't care about any of that. And finally, we refiled our application. And we asked them, said, well, why, out of all these cases in the U.S., did you say our name was derogatory towards Asians, that the term slant is an inherent racial slur when it has never been done in the history of the U.S.? Almost 800 other applications for the term slant have been approved. Why did you choose this particular case as one that was disparaging to Asians? And their attorney said, he said, there's no doubt. It is irrefutable that the applicant is Asian American. And he said, so in other words, if I were white, this would not have been an issue. He said his rationale was that because we're Asian, people automatically assume it's a racial slur and not think of the actual dictionary definition or the conventional definitions for the term slant. And so that's why we were denied. And he went on to say that we were actually too Asian about it. So he's like, well, you have pictures of Asians on your website. You have dragons on your album cover. And it's like, you have all these things showing how Asian you are. And I was like, well, yeah, those pictures are of our band. And we like to use artwork that celebrate our respective cultural heritages. But his reasoning was that the more Asian we became about being Asian, the more offensive we were because people would automatically assume that it's a racial slur. And it even if we said things like, well, our intention's to show our perspective or our slant on life as people of color, it's like, it doesn't matter. Your intentions don't matter in this case. It's all about what we think people will perceive.
And this is not the first time a group of a certain minority has tried to reappropriate or reclaim a term and kind of been rejected on this purpose for these kind of filings for trademarks. Isn't that correct? You're saying other groups have faced similar.
Yes, that's true.
Business owners and things like that.
There are probably terms I can't say on air.
Right.
But what I can say is that almost every imaginable racial slur that you can think of for Asian Americans has been registered as trademarks by white Americans. Those same trademark applications were rejected by whenever an Asian American applicant applied. And this has been the case for other terms, not just for Asian Americans, mm-hmm. but people from the LGBTQ community, from other communities of color. So I looked over, I've been studying this for 5 years now. And when you look at the history of this, the law that's in place that we're fighting against, in the past 70 years, it has been disproportionately affecting communities of color or marginalized communities and disproportionately favoring those who tend to be white, who tend to be straight, and who tend to be very wealthy.
So, and then, we were just discussing outside, this is also concurrently, we have this case with the Redskins and that fiasco and other sports teams that have offensive names and logos and things. So what we're saying is that we have seen, people who are filing these trademarks who are white are winning their cases or getting their trademarks, whereas the groups who are actually trying to reclaim or use certain terms are getting resistance along the way. And there is a reality to the time and money and energy that people can, go forth with these kind of cases.
Definitely, because the whole rationale, the whole purpose, of reclaiming or reappropriating icons or symbols or terms, that is an argument that's not accepted by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, no matter how widely accepted it is within those communities. The only exception, and it's a really big one, was the hip-hop group NWA. They actually have a trademark registration, but it's for the initials NWA, and obviously it stands for it's cleverly hides the N-word in there. What's funny is that anybody who's familiar with NWA knows what those things what those words stand for. And if you were to take the trademark office's logic that people who associate that group with that term, they'll automatically think of a racial slur. Why did they get theirs approved but ours was rejected? If we're going to use
that's
that
what
same
I'm trying
kind of
to
logic.
Understand.
So it's just a very inconsistent legal process, and it seems to be very subjectively applied. Because how can one person make that decision for other people? The examining attorney who's been working on our case for the past 5 years on behalf of the trademark office is white. And in the last 5 years, he has not consulted a single Asian American on this particular issue. The only people that have written reports or decisions on our case from the trademark office have been Caucasians. And that's the thing that is just mind-boggling to me, because there are Asian Americans in the building. There are very vocal Asian Americans that they can talk to. They could say, hey, what does Angry Asian Man say about this? Or what are these mm-hmm. newspapers? What are these, you know, there's a White House Department for Asian American
Pacific Islanders. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you ask them what, you know, and the reason why is because all of those groups are in support of what we do. When we submitted our case, we said, hey, look, every single Asian American media source that's written about us believes that what we're doing is relevant, or at least important for the Asian American community to engage in.
Well, we're going to have to go. I mean, we're going to have to take a break in this moment just so that I can remind everyone that you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Sarika Mehta, and in the studio we have fellow Compass member Andrew Ye, and we are here with our guest Simon Tam, who is a bassist and founder of the of Portland's very own The Slants, which is our Chinatown dance rock band. We were just talking about the lawsuit that the band has filed against the United States Patent and Trademark Office because they were rejected on their application to have a name that is supposedly disparaging to Asian Americans. So that is an irony that is not left, you know, unnoticed. In any case, I wanted to kind of hash out this issue of reappropriation a little bit more. It's something that I think we all understand and we all support, but it's not really that simple. Sometimes it's jarring. That is to say, I feel like it's taken me personally a lifetime to teach people outside of my group, my cultural group or generation or whatever the case is, why it is inappropriate to use certain terms with certain groups of people. And then at the same time, our groups are reclaiming them, but there doesn't seem to be this education towards outsiders about what the meaning of all of this is. So can you comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think the people that like to reappropriate terms do it because they deliberately don't want outsiders to understand it, because they want it to be empowering for our communities and say, this is our particular space. And whether you understand it or not, you don't belong here. This is in a system that's overwhelmingly dominated by one particular culture, white culture. This is a particular space that's reserved for our respective communities. And I mean, I think it is something that's complicated, but it's something that deserves consideration, like many complex issues. You know, for me, I think of it like this, that, you know, our particular trademark office case represents, it's a very clear example of systemic racism. I mean, you have a government body on public record saying that they're denying us a right because of my race. I mean, you can't get more explicit than that, yet they refuse to think of it as racist. They think they're protecting Asian Americans. However, racism doesn't have to fit our stereotype of what it is in order for it to be racist. But I also think that our tools, our mechanisms for fighting and dismantling systemic racism don't necessarily have to fit our stereotype of what social justice looks like either. You know, when we started our particular band, we just had this tremendous outpouring from Asian Americans who were proud, who said for the first time they actually felt proud of the fact that they had slanted eyes and that they were really excited to kind of reclaim it. And also for us, when we approached non-Asian American audiences, it allowed us to create a point where we can create some more meaningful discussions around race and identity. I mean, I understand that not everybody gets it and not everyone supports it, but at least we can have those conversations in a meaningful manner where we could talk about our experiences in a way that people might not traditionally understand it as race or racism.
Especially, you mentioned talking about elders in our community who have learned about your band, about the music, and about the name. You know, they didn't have a space like when you performed for former Japanese interns and things like that who suffered in the internment camps.
Correct.
Tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, the probably one of the most inspirational moments of my music career was playing for internment camp survivors and them approaching me saying, like, number one, they thought their grandkids would love it. And I'm like, why aren't they here? But also for them telling me that they were proud that there was a new generation of Asian Americans who weren't afraid to take racism on, who weren't afraid to turn these stereotypes upside down, and that it made them so just filled with joy to see that there are people who aren't going to take what the system delivers, which, I mean, we live in a system that the government essentially likes to define our identities. They create these labels for us. And we said, you know, we're going to take our own route. We decide what we like to call ourselves or how we identify ourselves. Even just last year, I met George Takei, and he said our work was brilliant, which, you know, that was, I didn't know what to say about that. I was like, George Takei said we're cool. So, you know, done, drop the mic.
Stamp of approval. And it's not only elders who have survived those circumstances and didn't have a space to take on these terrible systemic challenges, but also young people have looked up to the band and finding an identity.
You know, so because a lot of times we're on the road and we do workshops and panels and that sort of thing. I talk about my experiences of being bullied as a kid. I mean, physically assaulted. You know, I still have scars on the top of my head when I was bashed in with a rock. And so these students come in and they can relate to the things we're saying and they find strength in it and solidarity. And so it is wonderful to be able to connect with Asian Americans of all ethnic backgrounds and of all generations and finding purpose and meaning in saying that we want to claim the space as our own and we want to do something about it while having some fun dance music to it.
Absolutely. I was curious, speaking of all of these issues we've just been discussing, on this show on APA Compass, we are often chatting with different Asian American artists who have to negotiate doing their art for the sake of art or for the sake of the love of the art. And also, they have to negotiate being slotted into this niche, into this label, kind of like what you were talking about at the beginning, like, well, we don't know how we feel about having a bunch of Asian Americans on a stage playing music. And this can be very stifling, so I was wondering if, beyond what you had started telling us at the beginning, if you've had other experiences with this or if you struggle with that.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly come across our challenges, but that was primarily in the beginning before we kind of became more established in our industry. You know, 2 years into this, we were approached by a very major label who had a very lucrative offer, but they wanted me to replace our singer with a white singer instead. They said Asian Americans don't sell. And it's just so, there have been some very explicit
experiences. They were that blunt about it?
Yeah, that's what they said. You know, and then a couple of years later, of course, the YouTube sensations just took over, proving them wrong. Far East Movement charted on billboards, proving them wrong. But people still hold this belief. I mean, If they didn't, you would see many more Asian Americans on television and film or hear them on the radio, which obviously it's not really happening. For us, we define ourselves as Asian Americans. We call ourselves an Asian American dance rock band. And I think we wanted to be very deliberate about this and say, you don't get to decide whether we fit into this or not. We're making that conscious decision. And when we do it with knowing that we want to do it to kind of exploit some of these stereotypes, show them for what they are, and show how they don't always apply to all of us or, you know, millions of us.
Well, that's a good segue into some things you have coming up next, like the TED Talks. Well, you've given a few TED Talks so far talking about language and race, and you have one coming up in Salem in mid-September. And another talk in Spokane in October, especially the one in Spokane. I don't know if it's a TED talk or if it's a different.
Yeah, it's TEDx Spokane.
Okay. And you call it Give Racism a Chance.
Yes.
Which is not to be confused with Give Peace a Chance. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was actually inspired by the community of Spokane when we performed there earlier this year. And just sitting down and talking with some of the students of color and saying how they were just were constantly facing racism, and the administration wasn't doing anything about it at their particular college. They had one half-time faculty member of color in a college with three campuses. They would have other students calling, using racial slurs with the students, sometimes staff members, and no one would call them out on it. And because they believed that they were diverse, they're like, well, we have an employee who is black, so therefore we're not racist. And that was their whole rationale. And I just thought, you know, they're not even allowing this discussion to take place because they don't believe that racism exists anymore. They're like, hey, Obama was elected, racism ended in the country, and people have this mindset. And so I wanted to say we need to give it a chance to exist so that we can talk about it and what are we going to do about it? Because it is an everyday reality that people of color across this country face. And so I'm really excited to be able to kind of talk about that and say, you know, it exists not only in, you know, when we talk about microaggressions, when we talk about the where are you from kind of questions, but also in our very public laws. You know, I mean, I'm fighting a case right now with the trademark office. There's still a law on the books in Florida that people of Chinese descent can't own property. And when it went up for on the ballot, it was rejected. The people wanted to keep it on the books. They didn't want it removed because there's a scare tactic of like illegal immigration taking over and taking up all the property. It's absurd to me that in this day and age, we still have a law like that, and that the public refuses to remove it.
Right, that is supported. So giving racism a chance for the purpose of dialogue.
Definitely. Yeah, and I deliberately wanted to have a more provocative title, and hopefully it's a wake-up to that community as mm-hmm. well as other ones out there who don't even want to acknowledge its existence.
Right. Well, for our listeners, how can they learn about these talks and how can they attend?
Well, I would say to go to the TEDx Salem or TEDx Spokane websites, and you can register and buy tickets to attend, or they actually will be put on online soon, probably by the end of the year as well. So if you know, I would encourage people to watch, to like, to share them, because if you look at the TED Talks, I mean, up until the last few years, they were not diverse at all. They tended to be wealthy, tech, white. Individuals, overwhelmingly male for a long time. And it's only in recent years that they started allowing women or people of color to speak. And even so, you have these thousands and thousands of inspirational talks and videos, and so few of them actually deal with race or identity. And there's like less than 10 that actually deal with racism. So I encourage people to share them, to watch them and say, this is a topic that's of interest to me, and to show the TED community that it is relevant as our human experience and that we need to really work through these issues.
Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I wanted to just quickly ask you to talk, you know, very, very quickly about your book that you just published, Music Business Hacks, The Daily Habits of the Self-Made Musician.
Sure. So I call it a cookbook for musicians. Rather than it being a cover-to-cover read, there's like a recipe. You want to launch a social media campaign? Here's step-by-step instructions on how to do it. And so the book is filled with about 2,000 hacks, so to speak, of different things that musicians or artists can apply to take control of their own careers, so they don't have to rely on a record label or manager or someone like that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Simon Tam, for joining us on APA Compass.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Simon.
But before we do close up, that was Simon Tam, bassist and founder of the band The Slants. And before we close, I want to make sure our listeners know where they can find out more about you. So what is your website?
www.theslants.com.
Great.
Or you could just Google The Slants and find us all over, as well as many stories about our lawsuit.
That is probably true. Well, I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to APA Compass. We'll be right back.
My name is Sarah Onitska. I'm 18 years old, and this is my Angry APA Minute. Being an Asian American in the college application process was tricky. Although we're considered a minority in America, being Asian can almost be a negative trait in the world of admissions. Fueled partially by the stereotype that all Asians are smart, coupled with the idea that there is an overabundance of Asian doctors and scientists, people seem to believe that we are the model minority. That is, we've risen above the oppression and racism of our past and into the loving arms of success. It's true, there are a higher percentage of Asian Americans going to college than other minorities, so it feels like perhaps we should be wearing our model minority status with pride. However, I soon realized the problems with the concept of a model minority and how it would impact me in my application process. The umbrella term Asian encompasses a broad range of people, each with a different tale of oppression in America. For example, the term Asian includes those of Japanese, Indian, Hmong, and Taiwanese descent, but the lives and cultures of each group are incredibly unique. Some types of Asian people statistically struggle more than others in America, so it's wrong to generalize by saying all Asians are succeeding. In addition, there are often differences between Asian families born and raised in America and those who immigrated from another country. No one family is alike, but society has basically painted Asians as a group of academically gifted robots. Have you ever heard the saying, all Asians look alike? Well, the problem extends past physical appearance in the college admissions world. Merely marking your race as Asian while applying to a college pits you against the rest of the high-achieving 4.0 GPA and 2,400 SAT Asian students. It's hard to stand out because the admissions counselors might view you as just another Asian. And there's even evidence now that the elite colleges have established an Asian quota where they're limiting the number of Asians they accept. For these reasons, I've read a number of articles urging me not to check off the Asian box on my applications, but I figured I couldn't hide anything, since my last name sounds Japanese anyway. Even so, it created a kind of personal and ethical dilemma. If I had a different last name, one that sounded more white, would I want to hide a major part of who I am? Would I want to go to a college that might have rejected me purely because of my race had they known? If faced with this situation, I honestly don't know what my answer would have been. I sometimes do wonder, though, whether marking myself as Asian might have impacted my chances at admission to the colleges where I applied. At schools with a smaller percentage of Asian students, it could only have benefited me. But at colleges with a higher percentage of Asian students, I wonder whether they even saw past my race, or whether I was just another Asian. And that's part of the problem with the stereotypical view of Asians. Everyone thinks you're supposed to be high-achieving. Like, it's expected. If you succeed in math, it's not that big of a deal since all Asians are good at math. If you're not so skilled in mathematics, people think, what? But all Asians are good at math. You can't win. Having these high standards cast on me made me feel as though I could never screw up, in fear of letting others down. To me, the model minority stereotype is just a great excuse for continued racism towards Asian people. People can squint their eyes, talk in a Chinese accent, and not have their actions labeled as racism. I've seen it. Deeming us a model
You've been listening to APA Compass. We want to say a special thank you to our guests, Alex Tizon, Simon Tam, and Sarah Unitska. Today's program was produced by Sarika Mehta and Andrew Ye. Tune in to APA Compass at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of every month here on KBOO Community Radio. If you have questions, comments, or ideas, you can connect with us through our Facebook account. Podcasts are available on apacompass.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening to APA Compass.
First chattel slavery, then Jim Crow, now mass incarceration. Over half of our prison population are people of color. Tune into Prison Pipeline to hear Jonina Abron Irvin and Lorenzo Irvin talk about prison slavery. That's Prison Pipeline, August 4th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, where host Dennis Bernstein features a new talk given by Ralph Nader this past Wednesday. At 11, host Shahid Hamid brings us the voices of Portland's African-American community on It Takes a Village. And at 11:30 on Between the Lines, we'll hear about how U.S. and NATO actions in Ukraine could trigger a new Cold War, and the state of Maine decides to block the export of tar sands oil. Well, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, and if you're not a current member, you are able to remedy that at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today. Now, Air Cascadia.
Cascadia. Today is Friday, August 1st, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. We're going to be speaking